This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday morning, February the 9th, and time for our Friday Week in Review. Every Friday after 8 o'clock, we welcome in two guests to talk with you about the news of the week, and we invite you to call in with the news story that caught your attention, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We'll cover some of the important developments internationally, nationally, and here in the state of Wisconsin with our two guests this week, Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, and she's a blogger, althaus.blogspot.com. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also joining us is Georgia Derslotti, professor of political science at Beloit College, visiting professor of political science at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Now, we have a lot of very, very heavy, serious, important issues that happened this week that we will discuss, but I'm going to do something a little bit different this week and start with what dominated the news yesterday afternoon. I happened to be home, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and often I'm looking at the cable news networks. It was all there was. Anna Nicole Smith collapsed at a hotel room in Florida and died. Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room, that's what was being talked about. Professor Althaus, you understand this. You don't think that this was crazy over exposure by the media.
Well, I wasn't sitting there watching it on TV. Mm. I was reading it online and writing about it, writing about how I felt about it. So I think I understand how people... It reminds me a little bit about when Michael Jackson was arrested and how much coverage there was of that. There's not enough detail to the story to warrant just staying with it, but I think people want to turn on the TV and see it. They want to see pictures of the person that they cared about or maybe mocked and ridiculed over the years. But certainly, in the case of Anna Nicole Smith, she was just this beautiful young woman who was sort of transformed into this larger-than-life sexual image that people projected a lot of their feelings onto, watched her sort of rise and fall and watched that she did all sorts of foolish things. I watched her reality show. And, there's real life in there, too. You could be beautiful. You could be acting like you're just bursting with sexuality more than anybody else. And then there's just joy in your life beyond and money beyond our little lives. And then, you could just drop dead at the age of 39. That's very real. That people engage with that. That's real life. It's also fake life, bizarrely. But a lot of American life is that sort of fake life of celebrities and this vicarious life. And she was sort of our vicarious sexuality in a lot of ways. Not that we wanted it. We didn't want to be married to a 90-year-old man, or it was very bizarre. So it was sort of like, in some ways, it reaffirmed our own sense of our own normal, dull lives that, she had this greater beauty, these larger breasts, and this bigger life and more money than us. But, we also sort of watched the downfall and would think, that's why it's better for me to live like this. But then when it actually comes to the end and she falls flat on her face and dies, that's that's a lot. And it makes it profound in a way that I think it makes it into a myth that we engage with.
Professor Derslotti, your take on the reaction to the death of Anna Nicole Smith.
Well, I never watched her reality show. I didn't follow her life that closely. I can say that Americans are fascinated with celebrity, and she certainly had the trappings of celebrity without the substance that might go with some other kinds of celebrity. But what substance she did have was really a Cinderella myth, a kind of sexy Cinderella. And she played upon all of the very finite but traditional sources of women's power, her sex appeal, the fact that she was willing to, in essence, become a trophy wife and made no bones about it. I mean, she was a trophy wife. She was hanging on the arm of that old guy who was really, really rich and, was like the worst of the stereotypes about women. At the same time, she was the best of the stereotypes about women. And it really, in the end, when her son died of, things that aren't very moral, and she plops over at the den at the end in the way that she did, you can see that this is some kind of morality tale that will live on. And, you know, it has, I'm sure, archetypal features to it that those who study mythology would be able to quickly point out. I mean, where's Joseph Campbell when we need him?
But it really, it was amazing how much interest there was in this story all yesterday afternoon and this morning.
I'm really with you on that. I was like, gee, Anna Nicole Smith, who was that again? You know, I was trying to jar why I should know her from my memory. And when it came out, I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, this is either a product of the need to fill 24/7 on those cable channels, or something, as Anne just suggested, something profound about the American psyche right now.
Yeah. Anything else, Professor?
Well, I mean, we may also want a break from the news that's a little hard. I mean, this we can start talking about and think of a lot of ideas that have to do with, you know, life and sex and gender politics and all sorts of things like that. But normally when we turn on the news, it's the news of the war, the news of the Libby trial, the news of the election that's way over a year away, 2 years away, whatever it is. You know, all of those things that we expect to see. And then something surprising happens. I think people sort of enjoy the break. But some of it is just the 24-hour news business. You're not really supposed to sit there and watch it all afternoon. They're expecting different people to keep tuning in. And then they think people are going to turn it on and they want to see Anna Nicole die.
Well, let's move on to another issue in the news that I guess involves a little bit of celebrity and TV celebrity anyway. The prosecution is resting its case. It did rest its case against the former White House aide, Louis Libby, following some courtroom drama involving a Sunday morning TV host. Tim Russert of Meet the Press was the last prosecution witness this week in the Louis Libby trial. Libby is accused of lying to investigators that are trying to trace the source of the leak about a CIA operative, Valerie Plame, the wife of Joe Wilson, a critic of the Bush administration. Professor Althaus, you first. What are we learning from this trial?
Well, I think it's interesting that there was this big investigation and it seemed like all of these people were involved and so much was going to happen. And then when it finally came down to it, just this tiny little part of it actually was chosen to take to trial. And some people said, well, why do anything at all? Why not just, you know, give up on the investigation and say that nothing was shown? But there was this little thing to be shown and some people thought it was odd to go forward with that. But I think if you look at what the prosecutor did this week, it was a crisp little trial with, I think, how many witnesses? Like only five witnesses or something like that. It was very neat. Or 5 days. I think there weren't many witnesses. It was very crisply presented. And there was a specific thing that happened that had to do with Scooter Libby having simply lied to the grand jury. And so he's being tried for perjury. And some people, but he lied about something that wouldn't have been a crime. And, you know, there are all these, you can try to pick apart what the prosecutor did. But as you see the trial unfold, it does seem to make sense. I mean, you shouldn't be lying to the grand jury. Whatever you're lying about, it suggests that there's some larger problem. And the prosecutor chose the part that he could crisply present. And it's hard to prove a perjury, but I think if you look at what unfolded over the course of the week, it looks like he presented what he had fairly well. Now, we haven't seen the defense's case yet,
right.
But it's all about discrediting the witnesses.
Yeah,
the witnesses have been cross-examined, so that part has already happened. And then it's we'll see what witnesses they present.
And Professor Derslati, the significance of Tim Russert taking the stand was that Louis Libby apparently said to investigators, well, you know, Tim Russert told me that Valerie Plame was Joe Wilson's wife. I didn't tell him. Isn't that why? And Tim Russert saying, no, that conversation didn't happen.
Right. And, you know, they capped it with perhaps the best known because he's a TV personality, journalist. They capped it with him, which, you know, I'll just agree with Anne that it was a very well-conducted trial. And I also agree with her that this seems to be a really small part of the whole. And we get worked up with Tim Russert, but, you know, let's remember the big picture here. I mean, our vice president siphoned off this little thing, siphoned off the real issue that our vice president doctored evidence that got us into Iraq. And this was all part of a smear campaign. We saw the tactics that this administration has used. This, in some regards, this is the wrong guy taking the fall, and we're not looking at the right thing. However, it is true that it was a neat, tidy trial, and I think they're going to get something, whereas it would be very difficult to charge the vice president with lying to the public, basically, and doing illegal things to get us here. And this one, there'll be something. Somebody will pay something. It's just the wrong guy for the wrong thing.
Let me take a short pause and remind listeners that you can join in as we talk about the news of the week in our Friday Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our two guests today, Georgia Derslati, a professor of political science at Beloit College, visiting professor of political science at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, blogger at althaus.blogspot.com. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Friday Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 21 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, February the 9th. Coming up this afternoon, it's Peter Donald's in for Ben Marins. He will host Your Views on the News after 4 o'clock, when you can call in with your thoughts and opinions on the top news stories of the week. And after 5, interesting topic, he's going to be talking with a new PBS Frontline documentary, producer of that documentary that uses the CIA agent Valerie Plame outing and investigation of a case study in the conflicting rights and responsibilities of prosecutors and the press. So it's the Frontline documentary, News War, Secrets, Sources, and Spin, after 5 o'clock this afternoon. This is the Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with our two guests today, Ann Althaus and Georgia Derslati. And the number for you to join in, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Let me play a clip from Senator Harry Reid, who was upset with his colleagues that stalled debate on the Iraq War resolution in the U.S. Senate.
I'm terribly disappointed that we haven't had the opportunity to vote on Senator Warner's, Senator Levin's resolution and on the McCain resolution, but we've heard enough about that. We're not going to be able to do that, and we'll move on to other things.
The House of Representatives decided to take up that particular resolution, and a resolution to vote against or to against a plan to send more troops to Iraq will come up for a vote in the House next week. Professor Althaus, what are your thoughts on whether or not Congress should pass a resolution that condemns or disapproves of the escalation of troops in Iraq?
Well, do you want to talk about what Senator Reid just said, claiming that you said something about stalling debate, but aren't they going to a vote? So which side is stalling?
The Senate's not going to take this up at the House of Representatives.
Uh-huh.
Well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they should vote for the resolution. I think they should support the president. He's trying something new. We should stay behind it and give it a chance to show to the enemy that we're just on the verge of giving up and that the president is out there alone is undercutting his chances of having some success. I mean, what is the point of doing that other than to just, score political points, make a show of doing something? I just don't think that's worth doing under these dire conditions.
Yeah, Professor Derslati?
Well, a preponderance of experts in the area suggest that we need to do something different than we have been doing, because otherwise the Iraqis are not going to step up and they're not going to change the direction they're going. So this is doing something. Now, let me come back to Congress. So I think that they should debate it and we should have it out. And coming back to Congress, this is precisely what Congress is supposed to do. It is supposed to debate. It is supposed to take the views of the country into account and to lay it out. Now, I know it looks bad for the Senate to be sidetracked on this procedural matter, and actually this way of doing business has escalated over the past several, well, at least the last couple of decades, so that they're less likely to take things up this way. But what the Senate is doing is protecting a minority view, and right now the minority view is to follow the president's lead on this one. It's pretty clear in the polls. The House, on the other hand, which has more rules and can be more centrally controlled despite the fact it's bigger by its norms and rules, in fact, will be able to have the kind of straightforward debate that we could have had in the Senate where, you know, they are the debaters. But this will be a more controlled kind of debate and will be much, I think, simpler than what would have happened in the Senate. So perhaps we're coming out okay. I'm glad that the House decided to have a debate.
Yeah, you don't think, Professor Durslotti, that this hurts the entire effort, reduces morale of the troops, is the worst time to do something like this at this critical time?
I think it is both a problem and among our few solutions simultaneously. It's not an either-or, it's a both-and.
You know, I concede that the whole strategy of the surge is a political move by Bush because, you know, he's really made a sort of a chess move. And no matter what the Congress does, Bush stands a good chance of coming out ahead because if they don't support him, he can say it failed because they didn't support him. If they do support him, then it ends up being, well, I've just bought your silence for the next 6 months. Don't criticize me. But if you do, I'll say it's your fault. I think being put into that position is very frustrating for people who oppose the war.
Yeah, take a caller, Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, I want to talk about Paul Bremer, the former head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. We already knew his judgment was poor by his disbanding the Iraqi army immediately after the war, and that he chose his team based on their political views instead of their competence. We found out this week that he distributed $12 billion, three tons of $100 bills, without getting a receipt. The fact of his poor judgment, managerial incompetence, fiscal irresponsibility, and great hair can mean only one thing. He should be the Republican nominee for president in 2008.
All right. Thanks very much, Dave. What about the lost cash in Iraq, Georgia Durslotti?
It's highly problematic. It's highly problematic. On the one hand, we can say it was largely chaos. They didn't have banking systems operating. They didn't have the government accounting systems in place and moving forward. They were probably weakened under Saddam anyway. And, you know, at that moment after the looting, they didn't have their computers. They didn't, you know. So what's an administrator supposed to do? On the other hand, it's breathtaking what happened. And given a culture of corruption in the area, it's breathtaking that $12 billion, with a B, of our dollars disappeared, and we don't have anything really to show for them. Mm-hmm. This isn't brand new, by the way. We knew this about Bremer quite a while ago.
How much it's Bremer's fault personally or if it was inherent in the situation, as Georgia indicates. I mean, it's part of the larger problem with Iraq that if you're going to start a war and unsettle something that's somewhat stable, you have to have some way of dealing with the chaos that you've unleashed. And, it's very sad to see how it's unfolded over the years. And I'm sure there's more that we haven't heard yet.
It's really, I don't think there was anything particularly new in this. So, you know, we knew all this stuff already, but it just reiterates how poorly managed this was by the Bush administration.
Pat in Richland Center. Hi, Pat.
Thank you for taking my call. Let's do with what we know here about Iraq to begin with, okay? We know that to do a war of choice like Bush did, and, you know, with his lies and stuff, is the most morally and ethically bankrupt thing a human can do. We know that. Okay, now, we also know that there's a lot of innocent people dying and this sort of thing in our name and with our checkbook, and the lady that likes this war now, I'd like her to explain to us, if she would please, how if we could just magically get the troops out of there right now as quick as possible and quit the killing in my name and your name and all of our name, how that would be a step in the wrong direction. And don't give us this stuff about, well, the Iranians are moving, because it's their part of the world. But anyway, would you please fill us in how that could be a step in the wrong direction to quit the killing now?
Well, I assume I'm the lady who likes the war. No one likes, well, maybe some people like war, but I don't accept that as a term to refer to me at. I'm not as the lady who likes the war. I don't like, and the idea that people who support the war enjoy killing and the people who are opposed to the war are the people who hate death, it's just not that simple. The fact is that at this point, if we were to pull out, I think most people think there would be a bloodbath. Now, maybe it's fine with you that fewer of our people would die and Iraqis would die. But I personally think we owe the Iraqis a huge responsibility for the unsettling of the situation, and that we're responsible, and we can't just say, no more of this for us. You can all kill each other, which is what people think would happen. I would like to know if the man who doesn't support the war is willing to accept the bloodbath that would occur.
I'm not going to ask Pat that, but I'm going to ask Georgia Gerstlatty, about, I guess, the other side there. What happens if we withdraw? Isn't there going to be a bloodbath, and is that okay?
There probably will be a bloodbath. Looks to me like there is, I don't know if it's a full bath, but we got a sink full of blood right now. And,
just a light blood, a short blood shower.
This is disgusting conversation the way we're posing it, but Tom Friedman says, and I take his point of view very seriously when he's talking about the Mideast. One thing that we have right now is no leverage. We have no leverage. And one of the few things we have to leverage in this region of the world, where if you don't have any leverage, you really can't move anything, is to say, we're going to pull out. And what he suggested in a column I read it this weekend was that we just take all of our troops and say, we're going to pull them to the borders of your country and protect your borders. And you, Iraqi government, step up. And that's a really interesting point of view. It's something in between pulling out entirely and stopping what would happen. I mean, we would see what would happen. Will the Iraqi government step up? There's been a few indications that they're starting to do a little bit that would be necessary to stop. So the question is, you know, what is the best strategy and maybe even a number of tactics that would accompany it to move forward rather than just in this terrible stalemate that we seem to be in right now?
But isn't that what the surge is?
We'll find out, won't we?
Because it's going to go forward.
But what Friedman was saying, which I thought was interesting, go ahead and put more troops in there, but pull them to the border and say, Iraqis, until you do a few things, we're going to sit here.
Well, I don't know how Tom Friedman knows exactly where the troops should be put. I mean, I assume that Bush has his advisors and his military strategists and that they have, well, I mean, to say that they have a plan, it's sort of like, well, why didn't they have more of a plan before? So I can see why people don't trust them. But something needs to be done. And Bush's approach is about ending the war just as much as anyone else's is.
I think
only really irresponsible people say, just give up and take everyone out.
There are at least as many and arguably more military advisors, diplomatic advisors, war strategists who say this is the wrong thing. What they were all saying before is go in with enough troops to really make a difference. Around 100,000 was the number that was bandied about most often, or get out. And so this small surge, small escalation, from everything I heard before he decided to do this, in that long and tortured period over the holidays where he was gathering up all of his advice, that this was the absolute worst of all the options, and this is the one he picked. And in this regard, it makes no sense. What it is, it's pragmatic.
He can actually get this number of troops.
You know, we can't hire enough new people in our volunteer military.
What would have been his motivation?
And he can only put in so many who have been back for the third time. I have a former student, captain in the Marines, who's back there for his third time. This is all he could actually muster. So it was a pragmatic strategy of what he could do.
Georgia, what is your theory for why he would choose the worst approach? I mean, why would he do that? He chose an approach. He's the commander-in-chief. We can't just take a plebiscite of all the possible people who have opinions and go with the one that's most popular. He has to make decisions. He's made a decision.
And he's
presumably he did
poor
it for some reason.
Making in this throughout the entire thing. So why
what
should
gonna...
most of us believe that he's making a good decision now?
I just don't see what alternative there is than to accept that he's the commander-in-chief and he is going to make the decision. I know it's frustrating, but the idea that he has, I mean, it doesn't make sense to say that he would choose something that is the worst possible thing to do. He's obviously trying to win.
Well, I think we can disagree on his decision-making ability around the entire Iraq event.
I didn't disagree about his decision-making ability. I just said he is the person in the position that has to make the decision.
And I would say he's made a bad one.
Right, but you have to agree with me that he's the commander-in-chief.
Well, that's a pretty minor thing to agree upon.
let's talk about this issue in the news, too, this week. A warning to the United States from Iran. Strike us and we will hit back. President Bush has ordered American troops to act against Iranians suspected of being involved in the Iraqi insurgency. He deployed a second aircraft carrier to the Gulf area as a warning to Iran. And now the Ayatollah Khamenei says if the U.S. were to attack Iran, his country would respond by striking U.S. interests all over the world. Does that make you nervous, Professor Althaus?
Well, they're always threatening us. Mm-hmm. Is this anything new? It's always the saber rattling. Presumably, they would fight back if we fought them. I mean, I don't think that that's news, really.
Mm-hmm. Professor Durislati?
You know, what a surprise. But seriously, you know, I mean, Bush has set up his axis of evil, and Iran's one of them. I hope we talk about Korea, because there seems to be something happening over there. And, you know, we went, as we were going, getting ready to go into Iraq, I kept asking my students, now what would happen if somebody did this to us? Do you think we'd roll over and say, oh, this is so good? Or would nationalism run rampant? And of course nationalism is going to run rampant. I don't know how come we continue to underestimate how much a people will protect its territory and its way of life, whether it's the best way of life or not. So, I mean, what are we doing again?
Yeah, well, let's talk about North Korea. It says here, Associated Press report, there may be a breakthrough in efforts to get the North Koreans to give up their nuclear ambitions. Professor Durislati?
Well, I've always thought that North Korea was the mouse that roared. Unfortunately, it was roaring with nuclear weapons. It has made its test. It is now among the nuclear club. It's in pretty dire straits. What was it? $34 million that we had locked up in the bank, and that's what froze the talks in the first place. Of course, that was a pretense for Bush, the saber rattling against it. It looks like the Bush administration is now about to do what it so chastised the Clinton administration to do with North Korea, and actually talk to it and make some deals of resources in exchange for their good behavior. So this is a good thing. I actually think two things are driving this, and I really don't care because I'm glad to see it happening. One of them is Bush's low poll ratings. He needs to do something that looks good, and this would be that very thing. And the other one is that it's China who's really more influential over North Korea than we are. And China is upset with them, and they're very big and large, close neighbors.
Anything to add to this,
Professor Althaus? Not much. I hope it's successful, whatever they figure out they can do. Obviously, there are not a lot of options, and I hope this works.
Let me bring in a caller, Patty in Rice Lake. Hi, Patty.
Yes, hi. Good morning, ladies. One of your guests kept asking the other guest, why would President Bush choose what seemed to be the worst option? And here's my guesstimates as to why I do that. Number one, everything's about politics, not about necessarily being the best commander-in-chief, which he really has no experience at anyway, no military experience to speak of, no military service to speak of. So I don't think he's real qualified to be commander-in-chief, although he is indeed that. But I think it all comes down to politics. And in politics, you can't be a loser. You can't lose. You always have to have the face of being a winner, even if you are losing. So I think that's part of it. The other part of it, I think, is he's known for a while he wants to go into Iran. So if we send more troops over there, we might be ready in a better position to attack anybody else in the region that he feels that we should be doing. So those are kind of my guesstimates.
Well,
as
that seems illogical to me, because you said, my question was, why would he choose a bad option? And you said because it's all politics. But nothing would be more politically successful than to win and have successes. All of his problems, wait a minute, all of his problems result from the fact that after we started the war, we didn't have reliable successes along the way. All of the problems come from that. If we had had a news of successes along the way, none of these political problems would have occurred. So his motivation, even if it's 100% political, is still all about trying to be successful. So that's no answer to my question, why would he choose a bad option?
Yeah, because he wants to get ready to go into Iran,
He should still be successful. If he wants to set up another war, he needs to be successful in this war. That doesn't answer my question, why would he pick a bad option?
Well, Patty points to politics, and you all might recall that Karl Rove told us that he was going to be in this war in time for the 2004 election, which was deplorable when he did it. And, it's just beyond, wag the dog. If I could just say more clearly why he chose a bad option, Anne, he doesn't really have any other options. When I said it was pragmatic,
so he chose the best option, in other words.
He only has one.
Well, you said he chose the worst option.
Just listen. You didn't listen to me last time. Listen to me this time. He does not pragmatically have the capacity to mount the campaign of a large surge. He can't get that many troops. They don't join the military right now, and he has everybody who's in there coming back for their second and third time. This is the largest number of troops that he could muster. And if he was going to try to add to the mix in order to try to stabilize the situation, I mean, a stabilizing situation, presumably you have to put more people in there on the ground to do it. And this is all he could get.
But
so his
Georgia,
option is his only one.
But, okay, Georgia, then you have conceded that what you said before was wrong. What you said before was that there were other options and he picked the worst one. Wait, let me finish now. You said he had other options and he picked the worst one.
He could
now you're saying, no, Georgia, you told
me. Wait, go
Georgia,
ahead.
You told me to let you finish. Now let me finish. You said before there were other options like the ones that Congress is presenting, but he somehow chose the worst option. And I said, what would be his motivation to choose the worst option? Now you come forward and say he chose that option because it's the only option. So you have conceded the point to me.
I have not conceded a thing on this point. He can't do the option that militarily would have him win, and he refuses to pull out. Therefore, pragmatically, he can only add a small number of troops, which most everyone who knows more about this than you and I do said was not likely to do the outcome that he wants.
I'm going to have to call it a draw because we're at way past break time and we need to move on to some other issues. This is the Friday Week in Review, talking about the major news stories of the week. And we're going to move on to some presidential politics and state issues coming up after the break. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest for this week's Friday Week in Review, Anne Althaus, a professor of law at UW-Madison, and Georgia Derslotti, a professor of political science at Beloit College. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you puff yourself to death, tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hate to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette.
We're going to talk a little bit about smoking in politics because a couple of issues in the news regarding smoking in politics. I had a little bit of fun earlier this morning with a guest talking about Barack Obama, who will officially, make it official tomorrow that he's running for president. Also in the news this week about his attempt to quit smoking. I didn't know that he was a smoker and that he was going to have to quit. And we talked about whether this was a big political liability or a big deal or not. Professor Althaus, is this a big deal?
Well, I've heard it put this way, that he seems like such a superhuman person. Like everybody talks about him as if he's almost godlike. I think some of that is ridiculous for various reasons. But some people say that having a little bit of a flaw is actually better for his, it's humanizing. And people can identify with that. People have various kinds of problems of overeating, smoking, substance abuse. People can identify with that. It's sort of like now he's not a complete superhero. He's also a human being.
Yeah.
And, smoking actually is a little bit glamorous, even though we're not supposed to do it.
Professor Drislotti.
I don't think smoking is glamorous anymore. It certainly was at one point. I think Ann makes a good point. This is like Clinton and his Big Macs when he was on the trail. And, his overeating of junk food, which, of course, he now swears off entirely because of his heart. You know, it's an issue, as she said, to the extent that we know he's human now, that he doesn't totally walk on water. But I think the whole smoking area and, taverns versus restaurants in Wisconsin right now, this is something that's in the news. It's one of the things we know that we can do to really improve the health of the nation and drive down health care costs, which are totally out of control. And so that this is his human foible really does feed into the smoking politics, as you suggested, Joy.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about Governor Doyle's comments this week about the proposed statewide smoking ban in public places. He wants to prohibit smoking in any workplace, including bars and restaurants. But this week said, well, if there's an exemption for taverns, I would accept that if I can get 95% of what I want. So there was a little bit of indication that there'd be room for compromise here, which caused the Tavern League to cheer and the Restaurant Association to complain, saying, hey, wait a minute, if there's going to be a ban, it should include all taverns too, because our restaurants will be hurt if you. So what about that, Professor Althaus?
Wow. Mm. Well, I really feel for the people who need their jobs and work in a place and want to be in a smoke-free environment. I think it's really a shame to have coworkers around you who are smoking or clients around you who are smoking. And so I'd probably come down on the health side, but I understand how the bars feel. I understand how the restaurants feel. It's a complex problem. And the fact is people are addicted to it, and a lot of people want to drink and smoke at the same time. Whether those people drive up the health care costs or die young and save us a lot of money that we would have to pay in their old age. I don't know. I'm not sure the economics of all of that, but I sort of think that's a grisly economics, and the real question should be, it would be nice if people had all good habits, but, going to a bar and drinking isn't particularly such a good habit. You could collect all your vices in one place.
Do you think, Professor Drislotti, there's a chance we'll get a statewide smoking ban that will exempt taverns?
I think there's a real good chance because it's such a deep part of our culture, taverns. And we smoke more than most states in the nation. For the north central states, we definitely smoke more. So, this is, and it's probably tied to the taverns in our drinking culture. So, I think that there's a really good chance, and it would put Doyle in good political stand. I hate going into restaurants and having the smoke, even though I once was a smoker. I also know how hard it was to quit. And so, you got a lot of different elements going here that would make that compromise a good compromise. I do think the one interesting part about this would be, what defines a tavern. And I know this may seem like splitting hairs, and I suspect that anything that might be a bar, and it has to do with how much food is sold. Many bars do not really sell food besides, chips or something they can pull down. And not really have to prepare. It's the whole notion of concentrating the smokers so the rest of us can avoid them in places where there is some food, but some small portion of food, I think would be one way around it. And then we could actually have bars, we could go get a drink without having the smoke. Now, that would be some kind of ideal cutting it, and let the market prevail on this.
Let me take a caller. We're going to said we'd talk about presidential politics, and another candidate made it official this week. Simon in Indiana, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, good morning. I was going to, before I get to the question, I just have to comment on something the previous caller said, which is that she intimated that Bush was unqualified to be commander-in-chief because he has no military experience. Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt had no military experience, and my recollection is that they did okay.
Right, the caller brought that, but go ahead with your issue.
Sure.
Roosevelt actually had military experience.
He was Secretary of the Navy. He never
served.
That's
better
not
than
experience. In any event, it's become clear that Rudy Giuliani's jumping into the race, and Anne suggested on her blog that she's pretty happy about that. My question is, given that he would almost certainly have to nominate someone to his right in order to go forward, would Anne be happy with someone like a Michael Steele or a Newt Gingrich as a vice presidential nominee, or is that a poison pill? And perhaps to broaden it so that Georgia can participate, is there anyone that Hillary or Obama could nominate who would be a poison pill for her that would stop her from nominating?
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll have both of our guests participate. You're happy, Anne Althaus, that Rudy Giuliani?
Oh, I have to say, if I had to vote today, I would vote for Giuliani. He's my favorite candidate. He's socially liberal, which I like, but he's strong on national security. That's exactly what I like. And I think that he's doing a terrific job in presenting himself in a way that social conservatives can like him. I think a lot of social conservatives really do care a lot about national security. That's the biggest thing the president needs to do. And I think he's showing respect for them. He is talking about, as far as appointing people to the Supreme Court, appointing people like Scalia and Robertson Alito. He's been saying that. So I think that he is making a bridge to those people. As far as whether he could do some more of that with his vice presidential choice, I don't know. I don't know that vice presidential choices make all that much difference. They don't matter that much to me, but so I would probably, depending on who his opponent was, I would probably be extremely supportive of him picking whoever would help him get elected.
Your take, Professor Draslati, on Rudy Giuliani?
Flip-flopper.
Uh-oh.
No, seriously, the New Yorkers are shocked at his positioning right now. This is not the Rudy they knew. So it'll be, you know, I actually don't think he's going to win the nomination, so it probably, you know, I don't think he's going to win. He's can't get through the primaries.
Let's take another caller, Sarah.
Well, there was also the question about Hillary Clinton. I mean, there's a counterpart question.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Clinton.
That's true.
How does she get through the primary? So, I mean, speaking of flip-flopping, and now everybody goes to the extreme to get through the primary. She's doing that, too. So, you know, there's a corresponding thing among the Democrats.
The difference is her star power with a sizable segment of the Democratic base. And it's certainly not all of it, and she has her challenges. I would never suggest that she doesn't have challenges there. But the difference is that she does have star power with a good portion of the base, and she also can take the money left over from her Senate race and dump it into a presidential race, and she has enormous fundraising capacity, and I think Rudy's going to have more trouble with that with the Republican base.
Sarah in Pell Lake, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to discuss a little bit about Bush's environmental stance, because he is awful. He has not only helped start whaling going again in off of Norwegian, but he's also tried to get drilling in Alaska.
Yeah, also, Sarah, I need you to talk about an issue that happened this week so we can talk about
it. Well, what it is, though, is I was getting to that.
We're almost out of time, so.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'll rush. The scientists who came and studied had this great study come out, and yet the Bush administration is still saying that global warming isn't happening. And I just want to have a few minutes to discuss about some of that going on.
Yeah, this report said that that global warming is here. It's unequivocal that it is most likely 95% man-made or human activity is contributing to it. I think the Bush administration isn't saying that it's not here, but there's still questions as to what's
caused. What could be done, and the costs of what would be done, if the extreme things would need to be done, and they wouldn't even change anything. I think, that sounds very pessimistic, but, maybe that's the way the facts look. I don't know.
Professor Draslati,
political issue.
There is the challenge of what to do with India and China, who want to pollute the environment just as much as we did as they develop. And because they're so huge, that will be, devastating to global warming, climate change. Sarah's right that Bush's policies do nothing to improve the situation and lots to make the situation worse. I'm a major proponent of alternative energy, wind power, etc. There are things that we could do. There are things that we're starting to do. And Bush really could turn a big chunk of our own around. And by us helping develop the technologies that then could be distributed throughout the world, we could make a huge difference here, but we're not going to with this administration.
There's another issue in the news this week that I wanted to get your take on. The Texas governor is in a little bit of hot water for signing an executive order requiring young girls, I think sixth graders, to get vaccinated against the HPV virus, the virus that causes cervical cancer. The legislature and other groups are upset that he did this with an executive order rather than having public debate on this. But it also brings up a legislation in Wisconsin that would also require this vaccination of sixth grade girls. There would be a parental opt-out in the Wisconsin legislation as there is in the Texas order. But I wondered, Professor Derslot, if you want to talk about the politics of this vaccine that can prevent cervical cancer. Should this be required for girls entering sixth grade in school?
Well, I understand the health research side of why they want to do this, and it makes sense from that point of view, but I do not see a reason to rush into it. The costs and benefits, we don't yet know enough about some of the long-term consequences of this vaccine. I hearken back to many of the other kinds of reproductive medicine policies that have experimented on women's bodies, and I just shudder to think we're doing this to sixth-grade girls. I would much rather see the strong recommendation to do it rather than to opt out. This just seems kind of backwards to me and a little too fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it should be proven to us as citizens that this needs to be done. My understanding is you're talking about vaccinating people against a disease that's caused by having multiple sexual partners. I don't like to think of sixth grade girls all setting out on a life of multiple sexual partners. Not everyone does. Yeah. They shouldn't need to have to get a vaccine.
We will leave it there since we're out of time. It was an interesting hour, a lively one. Georgia Derslotty, thank you very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
And Ann Althaus, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison. You can look at her blog, althaus.blogspot.com. And Georgia Derslotty, professor of political science at Beloit College, visiting professor of political science at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Thanks to them for being our guests for the Week in Review. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing the hour and to Cheryl Gasser for on-air production. And thank you for listening. If you would like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Or you can listen to our programs, which are archived on our website, wpr.org. Well, I hope you have a very nice weekend, and I hope you're here on Monday morning at 8 o'clock. I will be talking with a guest about the controversy over President Jimmy Carter's book. So more on that coming up on Monday. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.